Thank you, Latham and colleagues. Thank you for joining me. I propose to start with the sociology of this subject. Maybe you've noticed that when a bright idea appears in this subject or in physical science in general, the odds are pretty good that the idea has already been proposed but not recognized. Through my career, a long career, have seen many examples of this. One calls it multiple discoveries. And I thought nothing of it, just the way it was, until a few years ago, when I was reviewing how we got to where we are in cosmology in connection with that book. It struck me that this is rather a common phenomenon. Surely it means something. Surely other physical scientists have remarked on it. I set out to find any physical scientist who had remarked on this multiples phenomenon. I couldn't find any. If you know any good example, I'd love to hear it. But I did eventually come to recognize that sociologists are quite aware of the phenomenon. Here, for example, how do I cause this thing to advance? It doesn't want to move forward. Oh, who knows?
That's 1922.
Ogburn and Thomas, sociologists, are inventions inevitable? A note on social evolution. They set out to catalog examples of multiple discoveries. They had a broad set of topics from mathematics to practical inventions. I show a few examples of their 173 cases: the law of expansion of gas, continuity of gaseous and liquid states of matter. That's really good basic physics. Apparently Ramsey noticed it, somebody else I can't read. Mechanical equivalent of heat. Well, we all know about Joule, but how about Carnot, others? As good academics, Thomas and Ogburn, of course, asked what this might mean. And you see their conclusion: are inventions inevitable? This demolishes the great man theory of science. If Einstein had decided to become a musician, then we would very soon have had special relativity. Others were onto it. It would have taken longer to get general relativity, but I've in my career sat through two lectures, two colloquia by Oppenheimer and by Feynman, in which they argued, and it seems reasonable, that if you had just taken the technology of the classical field theory of electromagnetism and tried to write down a theory that conserves energy and momentum, you would arrive at Einstein's field equations. I would like now to talk about an example of this sort of multiplicity in the early stages of development of the hot Big Bang cosmology. Four people are the principal investigators in all this. Left to right, Bob Dickey, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and Yakov Zeldovich. Following World War II, these people decided each independently to get into cosmology, a subject that before the war was really kind of dull, bloodless, just mathematics. During the war, Bob Dickey did research on radar, so important to that war effort. Bob was doing the technology of radar. Hoyle was learning how to apply the radar to discover German bombers coming over and fighters. Zeldovich, during the war, made important contributions to the Soviet nuclear weapons program. As I'll discuss, that had serious implications. He, on the one hand, was deeply revered by the administration. He got 4 worker hero medals for his contributions. And these worker medals, when worn, gave him great clout with the bureaucracy. But they also meant he couldn't leave the Soviet Union. He knew too much. Meanwhile, George Gamow, second from the left, was an expert in nuclear physics before the war and had some interesting ideas during the war. He didn't do any war research, perhaps because he was an emigre from Ukraine, perhaps because he just couldn't take bureaucracy seriously. Just shortly after the war, he and his student Ralph Alpher and at first proposed a theory for how elements would be formed in an expanding universe. It led to a paper that's famous for its list of authors, Alpher, Beta, and Gamow. Beta introduced by hand to make an approximation to alpha, beta, gamma. That the paper was totally wrong. It had some interesting ideas, but the numbers didn't work out by a large factor. It's typical of Gamow that when he came up with a better idea, he only said the previous paper had some numerical errors. The paper he wrote in 1948 illustrates what I think the most spectacular physical intuition of any physicist I've encountered. He remarked that if the universe were hot in its early stages, filled with a sea of thermal radiation, then as you trace the temperature back in time, it gets higher and higher, and at a high enough temperature, it is going to thoroughly decompose any atomic nuclei. So you would expect that there'd be a gas of protons and neutrons. As the universe expands, the temperature drops, there reaches a critical point where neutrons and protons can combine to deuterons, and there is not enough energetic photons to decompose of the deuterons again. That sets a specific time at which elements can start to build up. Once you have an appreciable amount of deuterium, then particle exchange reactions can bring 2 deuterons together and make a tritium and a neutron, and further particle reactions can make the rest of the elements. He worked out what are many of the basic elements of the hot Big Bang theory. Because his freedom of thought was so great, he didn't really focus on this paper much after 1948, but the ideas were there. He recognized that if you put in the numbers to make an interesting amount of heavy elements, then the first thing what you're going to do is produce a lot of helium. The numbers he worked out suggested that the universe would come out of the hot Big Bang with about 50% helium and almost all the rest hydrogen. He wrote, it is well known that the abundance of helium is around 50% by mass. That wasn't known at all. Most astronomers thought that the helium abundance was small in the early universe, along with the abundance of the heavier elements. He also quite fully recognized that this hot universe would remain today with a sea of thermal radiation. But nothing much came of this for many years, because in part, I think, because Gamow gave it so little attention. And when he did, he started to introduce rather garbled interpretations. But it was known already in 1941 by McKellar and others at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Western Canada that there is a interstellar CN, cyanogen. And the interesting thing is you can detect the CN by its absorption line in the light from a star that passes through a cloud of CN. There's a sharp absorption line. What was curious already in 1941 is that one observed absorption from the excited level, the first excited level of CN. What put that CN in an excited level? One could think of dust hitting a particle, hitting the atoms and exciting them, but at the densities of interstellar space, that seemed unlikely. A possibility is that it's excited by radiation. If it were thermal radiation, it would be at a temperature he estimated of around 2.3 Kelvin. Fred Hoyle, in 1948, the year that Gamow wrote his paper on the subject, introduced the steady state theory along with Tommy Gold and Herman Bondi. Fred came to dislike intensely the hot Big Bang theory. He felt the steady state theory is physically much more attractive, philosophically at least. I didn't know Hoyle well. A few exchanges of discussions left me with a clear feeling that Fred felt that the scales of time and length in cosmology are just so immense that you'll never be able to empirically establish a cosmology. You must instead rely on philosophy. He could just not bring himself to accept that we were establishing an empirical cosmology. Meanwhile, Yakov Zeldovich in the Soviet Union knew about Gamow's work. And as he was at the Soviet equivalent of Los Alamos working on nuclear weapons, he asked the secretary to collect all of Gamow's old papers. That must have been a very dangerous move because, of course, Gamow was a refusenik, an emigre from Ukraine, which was part of the Soviet Union. That could have got Gamow into real trouble, but he had those four worker hero medals. Zeldovich was well aware that the oldest stars have low heavy element abundances. He thought surely old stars have little helium also. So he thought that Gamow's theory must be wrong because Gamow's theory predicts production of a lot of helium. You can see that if he had the ability to travel outside the Soviet Union and to talk to a few knowledgeable astronomers, he would have seen that that's wrong, that in fact the helium abundance is rather large. And it was in the Western world recognized that this is a real problem. What produced that helium? Jeff Burbidge, who was rather a skeptic of the hot Big Bang theory too, was very aware of the evidence that helium is abundant in our Milky Way galaxy. He wondered why it could be so abundant. He apparently didn't think to connect it up with Gamow's theory. Meanwhile, in Princeton, New Jersey, Bob Dickey decided on grounds that were interesting, but not worth the time to explain, that an elegant universe would have started out hot. Not because he wanted to understand the formation of the elements, but because he wanted to imagine that the universe was expanding after a bounce. The bounce, if hot enough, would have thermally decomposed all the heavy elements that would have been there before and give us a universe with almost pure hydrogen, he thought. But he also knew the technology of microwaves. He had invented during the war a microwave radiometer that was useful in exploring atmospheric absorption, which means atmospheric emission, at microwave wavelengths for the purpose of developing radar. He decided at just about the time that Gamow was inventing his theory, he decided in the early 1960s that that notion of a hot early universe was so interesting that someone ought to build a Dickey radiometer and point it up at the sky and see if we are in a sea of thermal radiation. As his postdocs and research groups people, David Wilkinson and Peter Roll, were building that radiometer, and as I was working out what would happen if the universe did have a hot early universe, or if for example, it had a cold early universe, what would be the consequences? Word of this experiment reached Bell Telephone Laboratories, some 30 miles by road from Princeton, where Arnold Penzias and Bob Wilson were working with the telescopes that had been built for the purpose of exploring communications by microwave radiation. Those experiments had great consequences. They gave us the horrible, to me, sight of students wandering our beautiful campus, looking at their cell phones instead of the world around them. But already in 1959, the engineers who were building these radiometers were puzzled to discover that their detectors were receiving more radiation than they could account for from anything sneaking into the antennas or being produced within the system, an excess that they put at around 2 degrees Kelvin. They were engineers, not physicists. They just put that aside. For the next 5 years, it remained a dirty little secret at the Bell Laboratories that their receivers were detecting too much radiation. Penzias and Wilson resolved to try to find the source of this radiation. They are to be deeply respected for their determination to find this, the refusal to give up, and to keep plugging away at every possible source of radiation, except, of course, they're not astronomers. They didn't think of radiation coming from outside. By the way, the Bell management is to be deeply respected too for letting these two people continue to struggle away at this. Word of the Princeton experiment reached them. The two experimental groups got together. It was decided maybe this is radiation from a hot early universe. Of course, the confirmation of that, or at least a first test, is there a lot of helium, soon to be recognized? Yes, there is a lot of helium, as you would expect in a hot Big Bang.
Oh, Jim? Mm-hmm. That question in the chat is a good one. Are the slides supposed to be advancing? Because we're still looking at the first four pictures.
You're still looking at the pictures, and I'm not going to advance them yet. What have I got next? Oh, yeah. No.
Okay, no problem. No problem. Just wanted to make sure there wasn't a glitch.
We've had enough glitches. But now you notice something that really is deep, I think. Well, let me remind you that a classic example of a multiple discovery is Wallace Darwin. Independently discovering the concept of evolution by natural selection. These were two Englishmen at a time when, among the upper classes, it was a fashion to collect beetles and otherwise examine the curiosities of the physical world. Also, England was developing into a merchant nation. It wanted to seize territories so it could establish trade, gather raw materials. So it's no surprise that two of these people, naturalists, who could afford to be naturalists, happened to be on the ground in places where one could see evidence of natural selection. The fact that these two people independently hit on the idea is immediately supportive of the notion, because two people with feet on the ground both deduced that this evolution must be happening. Here we have, in the case of the story I've just told, two big pieces of information. The thermal excitation of cyanogen, excess noise in microwave receivers, and excess helium. Three direct clues to a hot Big Bang, yet how long it took to bring them together. You see where I'm now leading. As I say, we had in our face collectively evidence of a hot Big Bang. It took decades to recognize it. I just can't resist the thought that there might be other curiosities in the phenomenology we have that are pointing to something fascinating if only we could see it. Are there other examples of discoveries to be recognized when we put the pieces together in the proper way? It's probably wishful thinking on my part, but I gotta hope that there are. And I'm going to discuss now some examples. First, an old problem. It's been known for a century that large galaxies come in essentially two types, spirals and ellipticals. There are intermediate cases. There are very disturbed galaxies, but they're not the common story. It's really, and it has been known for a century, a two-class system, spirals and ellipticals. There are other names for it, early and late, gas rich, gas poor, red or blue, but it's bimodal. And if it's bimodal, then we know that galaxy formation has to be a bistable process. We start with clouds of matter, gravity pulls them together, you make a galaxy. Often it's either a recognizable spiral or a recognizable elliptical. So what is a separatrix? What a wonderful question. It is a very simple phenomena. It's a simple question. So tell me, what is a separatrix that determines whether you'll be early or late type? You'll sometimes hear people say it's mass. Ellipticals tend to be large, spirals smaller. But that's not really the full story. There are large and small spirals, and there are large and small ellipticals. So it can't be directly mass. One does immediately think of angular momentum. But if you agree that angular momentum is transferred by gravity, which seems to work out quite well, and if gravity is not bimodal in its transfer, which you certainly don't see in numerical simulations, then it's not angular momentum, at least directly. One can think of ambient density. It's known for a long time again that the ratio of early to late types, ellipticals to spirals, is larger than average in regions of greater than average density. But that can't be the full story because, as I show in this slide, elliptical galaxies are a one parameter sequence. Shown here, already it's more than 15 years old, but this is good data. Logarithm of radius in the vertical, logarithm of a product of velocity, dispersion, luminosity, and radius in the denominator, the fundamental plane. I hope you can see that there are two contours of probability, one dashes, one's dots. And you see that they sit on top of each other, a spectacularly minor offset, one from the other, as you see in the upper left. This is the color magnitude relation, or no, it's a fundamental plane relation. And it's almost identically the same in regions of high ambient density and low ambient density for the two contours. Ellipticals don't care where they were born. You see the same thing in the color magnitude relation. It's charming. It is, of course, an interesting thing that ambient density controls the ratio of early to late types, ellipticals to spirals. But once a galaxy decides to be early type, it is formed in a way that's independent of the environment. And finally, we have these days quite detailed numerical simulations that do an impressively good job in producing approximations to real galaxies. I'm going to say a few negative things about that, so let me emphasize at the start, we mustn't blame the messengers. They're doing the best they can, and they're doing very well, and they're getting results that I'm going to argue don't make sense. So let's look at this. So in model galaxies that are spirals, disks, it is convenient and common practice to use a circularity parameter epsilon defined as the ratio. These are for stars moving in the plane of the galaxy, let us suppose for simplicity. the ratio of the angular momentum of a star, which is conserved more or less because the thing is more or less accurately symmetric, to the angular momentum of a star that was moving in circular orbit if it has the same energy. I don't know why this thing is in the way. Can I get rid of it? Yeah. Well, not really.
We don't see it, so it's not bothering us.
Well, you don't see it. Yeah. But I can't remember what I wanted to say if I don't see it. So where are we? How do we characterize these orbits? Well, take the circularity parameter, the angular momentum of a star divided by the angular momentum it would have if it were in circular motion with the same energy. The circularity parameter epsilon equal to 0.8 gives you an orbit that looks like what you see. It's highly eccentric. If you turn up the circularity parameter to 0.9, you notice the maximum is unity. Then the orbit is more circular, but still the velocity of dispersion in the radial direction is about a third of the circular velocity. That doesn't seem right to me. I have been attempting, why can't I? How do I go backward? Okay, here are some numerical models with distributions of the circularity parameter. Again, I emphasize these are serious people in this list of authors. They're doing the best they can, and we can't blame them if what they get doesn't look right. So here is a bunch of models. The horizontal axis is a circularity parameter. Can you see it? I can't, but no, we can get rid of that stupid thing. Anyway, here's a circularity parameter. It ranges in each of the little boxes from one on the right. That's a purely circular orbit. The minus one on the left, that's a circular orbit going the wrong direction. Epsilon equals zero means a galaxy that's in radial motion. So here is the distribution function of the circularity parameter. Here is 0.5. Here is 0.8. So yeah, there's quite a, Here, there are quite a few stars moving in a more circular orbit than this. But that's a pretty non-circular orbit. And you notice there's a whole lot more stuff down here that is wildly non-circular. These galaxies have stars moving at high velocities in the disk. Here is a spiral galaxy, a gorgeous image. You can pull it off the web. You notice the fine structure, the lines of young stars, the glow of older stars, the dust lanes running in. Could the stars in this galaxy have such horribly eccentric orbits as we see? Certainly not in the Milky Way. I should have mentioned that in the Milky Way, where is those numbers? In the Milky Way, the velocity dispersion is around 40 kilometers per second. That's okay, that's getting close if epsilon is 0.9, but most of the stars in these models have epsilon greater, less than 0.8. Absurdly large relative velocity dispersions in the disk. It's just not right. There are galaxies called S0s that look like this. They're said to be the result of removing all the gas from a spiral galaxy and allowing it to relax. I don't know how much weight to put on that. Never mind. These galaxies are not spirals of the sort we observe. They are rather high velocity dispersion systems, what you would normally term to be flattened ellipticals or S0 galaxies. S0 galaxies are uncommon, and we don't want to have elliptical galaxies that are as flat as these models. In short, we have a real problem, which I think is lovely because the phenomenon is so simply stated. What is the separatrix? The history is long. And surely there is a simple answer, if only we could hit on it now. I wonder if I can only hang on for another decade and see whether people are wondering at that point why the community missed a key point for so long. Am I dreaming? Well, let's see, we'll find out. At least some will. Another little, a nicely odd situation that I treasure. Here is the distribution of the known galaxies out to a given radius. It's 8 megaparsecs. The distances of these galaxies are known pretty well, so we can make orthogonal projections. On the left, you see a view, a map of the galaxies projected onto two dimensions. On the right, you see a view from the side, so you project it into the perpendicular direction. That means, for example, that this red galaxy, which is pretty bright, is this red galaxy. They're the same galaxies. We see that it's toward the edge of the sphere, but it's inland in this direction. Here's a big galaxy. That's this galaxy. So you get the picture? And now as you look at this, you notice that there is one small galaxy right here. And through the rest of, and there's another little one here, there may be two. I'm still confused on the detection. The nearest galaxy to this guy, KK246, is 5 megaparsecs away. This radius is 8 megaparsecs. It's sitting in wonderful isolation compared to these guys and in even these guys. Why is that region so dead empty? It used to be said that numerical simulations show that the mean density in a void is about 10% of the cosmic mean density. Can we think that the mean density in this big region is 10% of the cosmic mean, but we get one or two measly galaxies out of some 700? I ask you. Now, in fact, the community feels that there's no problem here, through the magic of abundance matching, I believe. Now, I have not checked this with anyone. This is all I've made for the purpose of this talk. I'll probably turn it into something else, but. Oh, first, of course, the phenomenological question. Is the local void really so empty? It's very, very hard to find little clumps of stars in the local void because the sky is full of stars and galaxies. How do you pick out the little galaxies? It's fortunate that 21 centimeters of radiation from atomic hydrogen has a sharp line, which is to say you have a redshift, which is to say you can place the position of a little cloud of atomic hydrogen in three dimensions, redshift and angular position. The Australian high-pass scan of the sky looked at each patch of sky that they observed, 8 minutes per patch. And that survey showed a big cloud of H1 around KK246, that little guy to the upper left, and found no other clouds in the region they could survey. The Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico identified another local void galaxy. That's this guy up in the one or two little guys. It too, I should have mentioned that for it, the nearest known galaxy is 5 megaparsecs away compared to 8 megaparsecs for the radius of this sphere. But then during a hurricane, the Arecibo telescope collapsed. The US federal government is no longer able to do anything adventurous. We've lost that magnificent instrument. Meerkat in Australia will do, no, South Africa will do better. We will see. Really, what I would love to see, how could you resist it? Do a 21 centimeter search of the area of the sky around KK246, out to several megaparsecs, let's say, and in a sensible range of redshifts, and just integrate the heck out of the sky. find every little scrap of 21 centimeter emission. It is human nature, isn't it, to be fascinated by exploration of new territory? I think it must be adaptive. What a wonderful opportunity. Explore the conditions in the local void. Now we have a hint to these conditions. By the way, I have a terrible habit of never, I guess I have lots of time, keeping track of time, but I guess we have a fair amount. So we have—
I wouldn't worry about it, go.
Good. We have these two dwarfs in that local void. Here they are imaged by space telescope. At least the one on the left is space telescope. I don't know where the image of this one on the right came from. They look similar. fascinating. The one on the right has just a little wispy hydrogen cloud around it, wispy and irregular. The one on the left has a great giant cloud of hydrogen around it. Here it is. On the left, you see an old photographic image of that galaxy. Terrible resolution, but perhaps you can see the contours of surface brightness in 21 centimeter emission. And on the left, you see it visualized. It's a great long flattened cloud, flattened presumably by rotation, although it's a little unnerving to see the lines of constant redshift. If this were a flattened system in equilibrium and rotating about its narrow axis, if the axis of rotation were along here, then these lines of constant redshift would go parallel all the way up and down. They don't. And here is the situation in a little more detail. On the left, an earlier development presentation of the data scanned by the space telescope, a more elegant image with defects such as this gap filled in. It's the same arrangement. You see these three stars. Well, we see one star as a galaxy and the other two are actual stars. You can see the little lines around them. The solid lines in the black and white image are lines of constant redshift. You would expect if this H1 cloud were rotating uniformly, the axis of rotation would be parallel to these lines of constant redshift, but they're tilted relative to the long axis of this galaxy. Why in the world tilted? Remember, this galaxy is sitting in splendid isolation as far as we can tell. What disturbed it? I draw your attention to the image on the right and ask you to use your imagination and be very hopeful. Do you think that this is a separate galaxy here? I tried this on an observer who I really respect, Brent Tully in Hawaii, a Canadian. And this Canadian said, nah, that's you're dreaming. I kind of think it is. If there were two galaxies and they were interacting, then we'd get odd effects such as what you see in the black and white image. So here it is, the question. What has KK's life been like? Why that tilt of the rotation axis? And let me also observe that this doesn't look like a system that is relaxed to dynamical equilibrium. To me, why this odd bend? I don't know. I kind of think it's the star distribution looks slightly disturbed, and the axis of rotation really doesn't look right. I might mention that you could, in principle, measure the rotation of streaming motion of the stars to see what their axis of rotation is. It is certainly true that this thing is elongated in this direction. You might expect it's rotating around an axis like that. That could be checked. You could get mean streaming motions of the stars. I have been pestering capable observers for quite some time. they haven't found or measured the rotation curve. I'd love to see the rotation curve. Wouldn't you? I mean, it's looking at us in the face and is trying to tell us something. What is it? Maybe there are nearby dark matter halos without detectable stars or H1. Wouldn't that be romantic? Or maybe I'm dreaming. Ah, let's see.
I see there's a comment from Douglas Scott. I don't know. Douglas, do you want to maybe say, I think I'm not sure Jim is looking at the chat. You could just say
I don't know about chats. No, here's a chat. Where is
I just assumed we'd do it at the end. I didn't want to interrupt.
Jim. Oh, well, let's see.
Either way.
Well, it's true. I tend to repeat myself, but after all, I think this is good stuff. And, I must just remind you of the days when everyone knew, almost everyone, that the universe is Einstein de Sitter. I used to enjoy going to conferences and giving the same lecture on the evidence that the mass density is less than Einstein de Sitter. It was kind of fun because I kept repeating the same arguments and they always seemed new to the audience because they didn't want to think about it. Maybe, of course, I've been spoiled and I'm just going to be going on and on about this. So why don't we pause? Of course, I think, yes, Douglas, I think there's something to be learned here. Just as that puzzle, why is there so much helium? Why is cyanogen appearing in the excited level? Those are two questions that bear repeating until finally we recognize that we had a hot universe. I might be fooling myself by going on at these details, or maybe not. And of course, my hope is maybe there's something there.
I just wonder if you have a suspicion for what it is, and or you have no idea. I mean, you're.
Oh, my ideas are so vague. As I think the practical answer is no. An idea I will be coming to the local supercluster. Maybe I'll just try one there. But let's move on a bit. Why is the local void so empty? How is it if the mass density is 10%, the number of stars is the number of galaxies is maybe 2 out of 800 or whatever it is, 700? Yes. Why is the local void so empty? Well, in fact, I got these slides mixed up. Here's a reminder. The local void is really, really empty. Look at the big notch in the left-hand side. Is this consistent with lambda CDM? Received wisdom these days is that it is consistent. It is, as far as I can see, a result of an application of abundance matching. Remember the game. You have constructed a numerical simulation of the formation of cosmic structure. You see that this simulation causes matter to gather in halos, clumps. So in a simulation, you have a galaxy that appears and it has a mass in dark matter, call that M halo. It has a mass in stars. And of course, you have from this simulation the distribution function in M halo. Observers will give us a distribution function in M stars. And you have a function to introduce the ratio of M stars to M halo as a function of M halo. Fair enough. You can choose that function, M star over M halo as a function of M halo, such that the halo mass function is the same, agrees with the numeric model, and the stellar mass function agrees with the observations. This is a case of fitting the theory to the observations. Nothing wrong with that, of course, but you have to bear in mind that if you adjusted the theory to fit the observations, you're not making a prediction. You're making a prescription. I don't know whether that's the full story for the explanation for why the vocal void is so empty. You see the point, of course, because there are lots of dark matter halos, you will assign them very little luminosity, so they don't contribute to the stellar mass function. Did I make myself more or less clear? In that void of talk, I will go on. The local supercluster. This is really fun. Here again, you see two the orthogonal projections of the local distribution of galaxies. Big ones in big red circles, middle-sized one in little red circles, and dwarfs in black circles. In the orthogonal projections, you can see that the local distribution has a plane, a clumpy plane, but there's a planar distribution of galaxies than with debris above and below. Gérard de Vaucouleurs, already back in the 1950s, saw this and was not seriously taken seriously until the 60s, when I think, among others, George J. Bell said, my goodness, it does seem as if there's a concentration of galaxies to a plane. We're in the plane. I should have said, of course, that we're in the center of this map. Then Peter Shaver, 1991, made a remarkable observation. I have to explain these plots. The ellipse is the plane of the local supercluster, here shown slightly tilted. So we see a tilted image of the plane of the local supercluster. Here is a galaxy. This line is projected from the position of the galaxy down to the plane of the local supercluster. We see that this galaxy is above the plane and it is toward the back. Here is a galaxy that is below the plane, and you see that it is toward the front slightly. I don't see a good illustration of somebody. In any case, you get the point, I trust. This galaxy is rather toward the back and it's above the plane. These three are about a little further toward the back and below the plane. So you get the idea. These are the strong and most luminous radio sources. These are some of the less luminous. And these are ordinary large galaxies. Wow, isn't that neat? I have talked about this for decades, literally, and Douglas will remember, but many will not, because they don't really find it interesting. Here's an illustration also of another point that people had recognized. The same local supercluster plane contains the nearby clusters of galaxies. You see them plotted. I should say this is an equal area plot. And in this plot, which is in galactic coordinates, so that the plane of our Milky Way galaxy is along its horizontal line, the plane of the local supercluster is kind of oddly shaped, but here it is. There are the great clusters. Here are the galaxies that are selected for their luminosity at 10 to 100 microns, discovered by the NASA, whatever it is, satellite. I can't remember the name of the satellite. These are luminous in the around 60 microns. Luminous, it is thought, because they're making stars at a high rate. You notice they're all over the place. But the clusters are in the plane of the local supercluster, along with luminous radio sources, but not ordinary galaxies. What's common about all of these? Let's see, I haven't shown you, I could, but I didn't get out the histogram. The most luminous elliptical galaxies There is a wonderful survey called TUMAS that picked up galaxies at 2 microns wavelength. That's a very good wavelength, I'm told. First, because at long wavelength, the obscuration by dust is less important. And at that wavelength, the luminosity is pretty much a good measure of the stellar mass, I'm informed. So good. In that catalog, John Hooker, the main driver, after Will Saunders, the main converter PSCZ, point source redshift catalog, Will Saunders, John Hukra, let's get all the redshifts. Beautiful work. We see two types of objects, clusters of galaxies I showed you, like to be near the plane of the local supercluster. We saw that powerful radio galaxies do too. And the most luminous of the elliptical galaxies are close to the plane of the local cluster also. There are spirals as luminous as the most luminous ellipticals, but they are not concentrated to the plane of the local supercluster, nor are galaxies that are luminous at 60 micron wavelengths. What seems to be common to the first class is black holes that are capable of powering radio sources. Also, of course, they like to be in clusters and rich groups. Now, it's an interesting thing that the Milky Way has a black hole in its center. It seems to be the rule that a large galaxy has a massive compact object in its center, almost certainly a giant black hole. Yet the black holes that are capable of powering radio sources are found close to the plane of the local supercluster, not scattered through this domain of three dimensions. As if something set up conditions for the formations of black holes along a plane, the plane of the local supercluster. Well, that's a pretty lame statement when you come right down to it. I don't know what that means, but my goodness, it's fascinating. I will keep hammering on this. Another, bulges of stars and spiral galaxies in theory and practice. Maybe you've noticed that in these magnificent simulations of galaxy formation, a lot of the luminosity ends up in a classical bulge of stars concentrated toward the center and often rising above the plane of the disk of stars. It really grabs me to consider that that's not what you see when you look. Go to the web and look up names of famous galaxies and you'll get magnificent images. Look at this gorgeous image. It looks like a discus, doesn't it? It's flat. I see a little glow of light in the center, mixed up with dust, but wow, it's flat. And here, that galaxy M101 I showed earlier, you notice in this enlargement from HST, that there is in the center a little glowing spot. That's a million solar masses of stars, about the mass of the black hole in our galaxy. And Cormody tells me he can't tell whether in that 10 to the 6 solar mass of stars, there might be a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole. But outside that little nuclear star cluster, you see the clouds, the streamers of dust rising right into the center. The spiral arms go all the way in. I wish I knew whether this contains a bulge of stars similar to what you see in simulations. It could be that there is a bulge of stars and that the contrast has been chosen so as to eliminate it. But that certainly isn't the naive and simple interpretation of what we see. To me, it's more like, hey, it's dead flat. Here is just some numbers. This counts the bulge and stellar halo relative to the total stellar mass of galaxies. Nearby galaxies show this distribution in red. Two of the best simulations I've been able to find, FIRE 2 is the dot dashed histogram, and Arugia, I don't know how to pronounce it, is a solid histogram, and they're different from the observations. I don't know whether the people who make these models are bothered about this, but I think it's kind of strange that you should be celebrating the beauty of a galaxy that isn't like this or this. Maybe I'm being unfair. Well, I see I have, in fact, yeah, just in time for discussion. First, I've been going on and on about problems. I hope it's fully understood. The cosmological tests that look at the universe in so many different ways and provide such a consistent picture make a case that I think is compelling. Lambda CDM theory is a good approximation to reality. It's a commonplace to say that this theory is incomplete. We all know that. We should pause to remind ourselves that so all of our other physical theories. Consider Maxwell's equations. They are incomplete. They fail miserably if you go to the wrong conditions, but they're a good approximation for lots of work, and they are a limiting case of quantum electrodynamics, which does much better, except, of course, it's incomplete. It's thought to be the residual left from splitting of the breaking of the symmetry of the strong and electroweak interactions, of the electroweak interaction. And of course, people are convinced that the electroweak model is only a limiting case of some deeper theory to be found. Curiosity-driven research, well, that's what you look for, ways to improve our theories, all of them. And we certainly have ample room in cosmology. On the theory side, well, I have standard things here. They're commonplace. They're deep, really deep, but commonplace. We all know it, and we live with it, and we get on with our work, and we hope someday to answer these questions. And of course, you can be sure that question will be resolved by raising a new question. And then on the evidence, I love Mr. McCauber, and I side with him. Something new and interesting will turn up. So I'll stop there and hope we have some discussion. If I go
all
to
right.
Chat.
Well, so feel free to applaud either by unmuting or via Zoom button pushing. Thank Jim for a great talk. So let me start by asking if any students have questions.
I can't resist drawing your attention to the chat, whatever that is. The obscure
yes.
We see eventually, the completely apparent takes longer.
Right, that is a relevant quote.
And who is AGRS?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Shaheen, Jabbar, are either Shaheen or Andrew students? We try to have one of the students speak first. If either of you is a student, go for it.
Yes.
Go.
All right.
Please.
So do you think the amount of curiosity-driven research in the field may have changed over time? Do you think it might be being suppressed for most researchers, especially young researchers? Maybe due to rapid research requirements and publication and so on.
Yes. We like to think that our science is impersonal. We are simply striving for the truth. But we're people, and we have prejudices. A horrible example, my esteemed colleague, Bill Anderson, who testified before Congress that the superconducting supercollider is a waste of time. You should support condensed matter physics. That's a suppression, wasn't it, of an instrument that could have done marvelous things. So yes, research is suppressed, not I think malevolently, but by the differences of opinion on what's going to reveal the greatest and best results. another form of suppression is simply lack of funding. I do feel uneasy. I guess I'm of an age when I can be curmudgeonly and say that Euclid is a magnificent project. But what strikes me about it is they're asking the old questions. We're going to add decimal places. Is that unfair?
Shaheen?
Okay. Thank you, Jim, for the very interesting talk. I have two questions. One is about the Hubble tension. I just want to know what are your take on this issue. And another question is about the framework, I mean the FLRW framework, which is based on cosmological principle, the isotropy and homogeneity in cosmic distances. Could that be violated, or do we see any deviation, signs of deviations from the cosmological principle?
Short answer to the second question is no. let me see. I have to admit that I've forgotten your first question. For the cosmological principle, we should be careful. The cosmological principle, sensibly stated, says that our universe is a sample from a stationary random process. Being a sample, it of course cannot be accurately homogeneous. There are lumps here and there. Some people argue that because, you know, there is the problem of understanding, reconciling the dipole of the magnetic, of the thermal radiation dipole with, which tells us how fast we are moving relative to the radiation, with the gravity we expect to be pulling on us from the large scale fluctuations in the distribution of matter. It's been very hard to make those two reconcile those two. Some cry that this is an indication that the cosmological principle failed. I think that's not at all the case. Remember, we have drawn our universe from a statistical ensemble. That universe drawn from that ensemble has mass not only inside, but there is mass outside our slice. And that mass outside the slice affects what's happening inside. You might say that that's a causal, but bear in mind the simple example of the electromagnetism, the divergence of E equal to rho, the charge density. That statement looks like it's acausal on the face of it. Rho is at a position, E is everywhere. But similarly, the velocity that we have relative to the radiation has a component due to material that's outside our Hubble length. It's pulling on the radiation, but it can pull more effectively on matter. And taking that all into account is a real mess. As for the Hubble anomaly, I am of three minds at least. First, I deeply respect the people on both sides of this debate, those who argue for a large H and those for small H. I can't add anything to the science that they're doing. I simply wait and occupy myself elsewhere until the situation is convincingly resolved. Because the lambda CDM theory passes so many demanding tests, it's easy for me to imagine that surely it'll pass this test too, that there is a subtle, deeply subtle systematic error hidden somewhere within the measurements. But then my third mind is, wouldn't it be exciting if there were a true anomaly? It would not, I think, mean that lambda CDM is to be abandoned. It would instead mean, I bet, that lambda CDM can be improved. A standard enough story. And remember, I can say this with some personal feeling because I introduced CDM and then lambda CDM. And I introduced what I did because it was the simplest thing I could get away with. No one told us that the universe will always choose the simplest thing it can get away with. I'm hoping that, in fact, the anomaly is real. And I'm hoping that people will set out looking for more anomalies and build up a case for a way to improve lambda CDM. Have I more or less covered what you were asking?
Yes, but as a follow-up, in generally, Hubble tension is attributed to to tell something about the dark energy.
I don't know about that. One idea is that the dark energy is slowly evolving, and maybe you can adjust parameters so that you remove that Hubble tension without introducing new tensions. It's a possibility. We don't have a serious theory to reconcile the two methods of estimating the Hubble parameter. We have ideas. I wouldn't put weight on any particular one of them. Instead, look at many possibilities, as people are doing exhaustively. I was told that there's some 1,000 papers on resolving the Hubble tension. Is that right?
It's of the same order, even more.
Well, I think it's time to think about something else. And what I would think about is other anomalies. What else? For example, it is impressive that the oldest stars in our galaxy, and stellar ages can be estimated pretty well in star clusters that are coeval. The oldest stars are about as old as the age of the universe since high density. They're slightly younger, which is to say there's no anomaly. But if you pressed the observations of stellar evolution ages really hard, might you discover some that are older than the universe? Wouldn't that be neat? Mm-hmm. I'm not recommending you do this, maybe you should. Mm-hmm. Maybe you should look for some other anomaly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are there any other questions?
Can you ask a question?
Yes, John.
Hi, Jim, this is John.
Hi.
Nice talk, thank you. So in 1973, you published a paper with Ostriker studying the stability of bars in spiral galaxies.
Yes.
And you proposed that to stabilize them, you need a dark matter halo in spirals.
Right.
So as you point out, why haven't decades of research revealed the dark matter? So in the lambda CDM model, a major part of the model is that we have to believe that dark matter is 86% of all matter. And the experiments that look for dark matter particles are null experiments. So we can never actually exclude experimentally dark matter. So my question is, what if the experiments continue not to find dark matter particles. What will that do for the standard model?
My philosophy is that we were never guaranteed that we could make sense of the nature of the world around us, the nature of the universe, the nature of stars and galaxies and people and subatomic particles. We had no guarantee. We just have gone blindly ahead and done a remarkably good job by and large. But questions remain and always will be, I think. And in particular, there's no guarantee that we will ever be able to detect the dark matter. If on the case we have now for the presence of dark matter is, in my estimation, about as compelling as it can get. If the dark matter is discovered, it will be wonderful. It'll open up all sorts of fields of inquiry. What is this dark matter? What is its nature? How does it fit into the standard theory of particle physics? If we don't discover it, well, the situation hasn't changed. We still have all those tests that are still, in my opinion, so compelling. You can't always get what you want. I think I'll write a song. Would you like to respond?
Well, the alternative is that gravity has to be changed. This is a possibility, which one can only take seriously if an experiment shows that it's the way forward. But we always have to look at different avenues in physics.
Oh, we certainly do. But of course, we also have to look at all the tests. It is true that people like Stacy McGraw rightly point out that if we only had the properties of galaxies, we would have the best theory to account for the properties of galaxies would be the Milgram hypothesis, modified gravity. But I just do not see how modified gravity without dark matter can account for the array of tests that we have. Consider one example. When I wrote out the original theory for the power spectrum of the angular distribution of the radiation, I had zeros one had the acoustic oscillations, decoupling, propagation of the present field, present situation. The galaxies in particular would have a power spectrum with zeros, because I didn't put in dust. And I didn't put in dark matter. Because of the dark matter, the fluctuations in the power spectrum of matter are quite modest, because the acoustic oscillations affect only the plasma, not the dark matter. If we didn't have the dark matter, the plasma would oscillate and produce zeros in the power spectrum of the matter distribution. It's just not seen. It's this array of considerations that, as you know, are broad and look at the universe from so many different directions, that convinces me that we're on the right track. I hasten to emphasize that I deeply respect Tracy McGaw. He's doing good science, but I just don't see how we can get away without dark matter.
Well, I have to respond because
please.
I have a modified gravity theory published papers recently by others too, in the, for example, in areas and so on. And we do fit the acoustical power spectrum, Planck 2018. In particular, for the dark matter power spectrum, which is important, it's possible to fit the dark matter spectrum, but there's not enough galaxies to show whether there are any of the thin zeros in the actual spectrum.
Oh, gosh. And
so I recommend reading these papers. I'm not saying that what I'm saying is correct, but it's something that should be taken into account.
We certainly should ask these questions. I feel deeply suspicious. Maybe there are not enough galaxies to see the zeros. That's not my recollection of these power spectrum I've seen. The radiation has also a power spectrum with zeros. They get smeared out because of the projection. But still, I'm so deeply impressed by the fit of theory and observation under standard general relativity theory for the anisotropy spectrum of the microwave radiation. Can you fit that well with modified gravity?
Yes.
And no dark matter?
Yes, without dark matter. When you look at the transfer function that produces the power spectrum, it has two parts. One is the baryon part, and the other is dark matter. Baryon part is a Bessel function, and it shows these spikes, unit oscillations. Mm-hmm. But you have to include a window function when you bin and look at the data. And the window function masks these spikes.
John, I wonder, this is something
we can discuss privately.
I was going to say that maybe that's the best thing. I just want to make sure there may be other questions here.
Of course.
Lee, go ahead.
Yes, Jim, beautiful, beautiful talk. I wanted to go back to your opening theme, which is the many discovery being made several times at once. Because that's, speaking of evidence, that's not the story I pulled from the evidence you presented. The evidence you presented had different facts held by different people who needed to come together and know all the same three facts. And that's a rather different story. And I wonder if you agree with that and if you have any advice from that. For example, we should mix up more.
I wonder if I can show, oh gosh. Ah, do you see this?
Yes.
Oh, no, I screwed it up. Can I get it?
Maybe, yeah.
Let me just give you this story, which I think is very much along the lines of my introductory remarks from the sociologists. 1973-74. People knew about the problem with the binding clusters of galaxies, particularly the Coma cluster. A few astronomers also were becoming aware, making a good case that there is, if you accept the inverse square law, dark matter around large galaxies.
Right.
That evidence was not well advertised, though. But in 73, 74, Alex Zelay and George Marx in Hungary, and Ram Kausik and John McClelland in the US independently introduced the idea that dark matter may be neutrinos with a rest mass of a few tens of EV. That has to have been independent, yet at the same time, they had in mind only the dark matter that apparently is in the Coma cluster. Yet they came up with this idea that attracted attention. Even more astounding, to my way of thinking, is that in 1977, the idea was introduced that there is a fourth class of neutrino of leptons with a neutrino with the standard Fermi V minus A interaction and mass of 3 GeV. You do the numbers, and at this mass, you get a cosmologically interesting residual mass density in this fourth class of neutrinos. That was introduced, as far as I can determine, independently by five groups. Pete Hutt was the first to submit a paper with this idea the day, my birthday, 25th of April. Ben Lee and Steve Weinberg were next, 13 May. Pete Hutt has told me that he received a letter from Lee and Weinberg, from Steven Weinberg, acknowledging that Hutt got there first. Mm-hmm. You can imagine the effect that had on Pete Hutt. He was floating in air.
Sure.
Alas, he, at my deep request, searched all his papers. He cannot find that letter. Anyway, next, Sato and Kobayashi, 23rd of May. Next, Kolb, Discus, Teplitz, 31st of May. That's a little different story. They had the idea of a fourth neutrino family that would have dark matter, but they knew after they had discovered this, they were in the same university as Weinberg. They saw, whoops, we've been scooped. So they published a paper on the notion that the dark matter may be the class of neutrinos that decays to another class of neutrinos. But I count it as an independent proposal. And then Zakub Zoldovich and colleagues in the SSR, he always was a font of knowledge about these things, but he was a little later, a month later, in introducing it, I think, independently. Isn't that remarkable? To me,
yes, that is a remarkable example of that. And there are others. But the original story you told about the cosmic microwave background,
yes,
has this other feature in which there are different facts known to different people in the scientific community.
Yes, and you notice that was the theme of my later remarks.
Yes.
That there are lots of facts out there that have not been explained, probably because they're irrelevant. But here and there, I got to hope there are facts that are relevant if only you look at them in the right direction. I'm not saying I know how to look at them in the right direction, but I'm hoping that someone may do so.
But this is a question from Perimeter Institute, since we're in the process of restarting up and relaunching ourselves. Mm-hmm. Supposing, is there a way to invite people who have these different pieces of knowledge to talk to each other so that maybe these things don't take so long to come to light?
Yes, it's a good thought. But you know, people are people.
Seems so.
Yeah, and people are irrational. That's all there is to that.
No. Really?
Occasional bursts of rationality. I have no idea how to foster independent thinking. Perhaps you have given thought to this.
Yes. Let's talk about it elsewhere.
Yes.
The best way I know how to foster independent thought is discovering people who are doing it and giving them homes to do it from.
You know, I'm reminded of Thomas and Egbert, the two sociologists in 1922, remarked that with the development of long distance telegraphy, we may expect to see far fewer multiple discoveries, because of course, once one person discovers, it will communicate to the world around us. We have now enormously broader bandwidth for communications. And I think it has only served to increase multiplicity of discoveries.
Yes.
Because all that communication adds up to noise.
Yes.
It's noise with stimulating signal tucked here and there. to be made use of. I really hate to see students walking around staring at their cell phones, but they are making communication. They're making contact somehow. And they're dropping little notions and they're exchanging information. And I think that's what you really want people to do.
Okay, so since we're a half hour past, unless there's a, well, I must say, let me just say, before I stop, I think there was two occasions where Niyash was about to ask a question and we got missed. Niyash, did you have a question that I passed over? Maybe Benjamin, do you have, is your question short? Because I'm sure, go for it, Benjamin. Let's.
Yes, I joined from Ghana and I'm. But then the little I could appreciate. I would like it if Prof is going to maybe briefly narrate me the formation of galaxy and some sort of evolution.
Sorry, I messed up. Would you repeat that?
Okay, I'm just saying that in order for me to appreciate what you presented, the network was quite unstable on my side. I'm joining from Ghana.
Yeah.
I would be very glad if you could maybe in some brief statement explain some formation of galaxy and its evolution, since I was seeing pictures of galaxies and they look very beautiful, but then the physical aspect behind it, I would appreciate it if you could maybe give some brief narrations about formation of galaxy and then its evolution. Yes.
A brief narration. This would be for popular consumption. I am not good with such things. I do not know how. You said something that I really, really like. These images of the nearby galaxies are beautiful. We evolved into the human race without ever, ever, ever seeing those images. Yet when they were obtained, we said, those of us who looked at them, isn't that beautiful? We weren't conditioned to admire galaxies, we simply do admire them. That means something important, but I'm no psychologist. I just don't see, I've written several books. I've never been able to bring myself to write a book for the non-scientist. When I taught, I often taught the range of courses, but sometimes introductory physics for engineers. Oh, that's okay. Introductory physics from pre-meds. Oh, I just don't know how to do it. I'm not going to produce a commentary. It's up to you. You have heard me speak. You can make a commentary.
All right, Paul. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Yes.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's thank Jim one more time for this long and wonderfully stimulating talk and conversation.